Hey, I'm Tom Power. I'm the host of the podcast Q with Tom Power, where we talk to all kinds of artists, actors, writers, musicians, painters. We had Green Day on the other day talking about their huge album, American Idiot. Nicole Byer came on to talk about ADHD and comedy. And then there's Dan Levy. While we were talking about filmmaking, we talked about his insecurities.
I sometimes feel like I have this desire to, like, perform, to be a version of myself that people might like.
Listen to Q with Tom Power to hear your favorite artists as they truly are, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Coming up on The Cost of Living.
I could put it on the floor between my left foot and the door, and then my left foot had to kind of keep it squished there so it wouldn't, the strap or whatever, wouldn't interfere with my right foot that was driving.
Peggy Worrell has been driving for 60 years. In all that time, one thing that's really bugged her, why is there no place for her purse? Hi, I'm Paul Havershrood. Welcome to The Cost of Living. Cars come with every option under the sun, including sunroofs. So how hard could it be to design a better spot for a purse? Also today, have you ever found a charge in your credit card for something you didn't buy? So you call the credit card company and they remove the charge. It's a relief. But who ends up paying? Up first, when it comes to the question of what is the middle class? Well, we know it when we see it. Or do we? We hear a lot about the middle class in this country. Politicians love talking about it.
The finance minister said yesterday that the middle class had not had a raise in a generation. I thought I'd look at his
having a meeting with his cabinet in Montreal, and he's talking about growing the middle class.
Canada to prosper. We need a strong and growing middle class.
Justin Trudeau's Liberals rode to power on a middle class message. Their first budget used the phrase middle class 114 times. The next year, it was 160 times. But to be fair, all parties fight for the hearts and minds of middle class voters. So when they say middle class, who exactly are they talking about?
People have different ideas about what it means to be in the middle class. But when you're appealing to the middle class, you're appealing to the sense of what a conventional, regular, comfortable life should be.
Antoine Genet Grégoire is an assistant professor at the University of Sherbrooke, where he researches tax policy and how it affects families. A funny thing about the middle class, for all we hear about it, there is no official definition of it. Economists look at things like household income. Sociologists consider education and where people work. Others define it by the life you aspire to, buying a house, having retirement savings, being able to send your kids to university. So, class, credentials, culture, the middle class isn't just one thing. But how we think of ourselves in relation to it can carry a lot of weight for our politics and the economy. Compared to other countries, Canada has a lot of people in the middle. It could be thought of as roughly 60% of the population. We can be thankful for that. Because in some ways, a country's economic standing can be defined by the size of its middle class.
You are talking about people who have the opportunity to invest in their own education, the education of their children, the opportunity to invest in the economy itself. So that is a useful thing to have. You know, people in the middle income, if the income distribution, are the ones who can save, and they, most of them will invest in very local things, or local in the sense of country. That's a base of consumers. So your own businesses can try to start growing just by selling in the internal market. But an internal market, you know, requires consumers who have disposable income, who have some, you know, some space to try on new products, new services.
A developing country may have a few ultra wealthy people at the top, a bunch of workers at the bottom, but no professional class in the middle. As Antoine says, workers with steady salaries who spend, save, and pay taxes. That kind of thing brings stability for a country's economy, but also for people living their lives.
You know, you're beyond meeting your basic needs. You have leisure. I think that's really what makes it aspirational, is that people want to be, want safety. They want to be in a situation where they have control over their life. So I think that's what people allude to when they're talking about the middle class. They're talking about the people who can, you know, choose the way they want to live, the people who have the opportunity to, you know, take vacations, invest in their children, that kind of thing that most people want, and then even those who can't most likely aspire to do those things.
So how much money does it take to do those things? That depends. Living in an expensive city will be different than life in a small town. But most economists define middle class by looking at a range of earnings. That range falls around the median after-tax household income. Now, using the median makes a ton of sense here, because in statistics, it means middle. For income, it's the point at which half of Canadian households earn more and half earn less. The middle class is defined as the big group of people around that point. So if we ballpark median income for Canada at $75,000 a year, the low end of middle class comes in at $55,000. Households at the top earn $115,000. So that's what the numbers say. $55,000 to $115,000, again, that's after taxes. Make that, and you're middle class. But numbers aren't everything. How we perceive ourselves is where things get more complicated.
People at the bottom know that they're at the bottom. People in the middle identify as middle. People at the bottom identify at the bottom. But the weird thing is people at the top still identify mostly as middle income.
Antoine says households can take home way more than $115,000 and think of themselves as middle class. Someone in the top 10% of Canadian earners, even the top 5%, can still consider themselves basically average.
It's hard to accept that you're rich if you're ordinary rich, not millionaire rich, but if you're ordinary rich, if you're making more than $100,000 or $200,000 a year, you're amongst the very richest Canadians. But I mean, you can't go to space, and you probably have maybe two houses, but you know, you don't live the crazy lifestyle that you can see on TV or in the movies. You're just very comfortable, but your life still resembles the one of some of your friends who maybe make half of your income or even, you know, a quarter of your income. So you're probably not inclined to think of yourself as the rich, which is somewhat of a stigmatized term as well.
So a lot of people don't see themselves as rich. And yeah, they're not Kardashian rich. But if your income says you make more than 90% of the country, you make more than almost everyone else, even if you don't feel like it. This perception, flawed or not, can help shape people's expectations on things like the role of government or how much you should pay in taxes. It could even influence how you vote.
It's a highly political concept. Politicians appeal to the middle class, and we generally say that the middle class makes or breaks governments. So, you know, you can expect people at the very bottom to want policies that are targeted very heavily towards redistribution, people at the top who are heavily against redistribution in large parts, but people at the middle will fluctuate.
Middle-class voters are a big group. They can swing elections in this country and often do. So talk of the middle class is highly political. And Antoine says it can also be highly ideological. Because whenever something is talked about as normal, it can imply that something else or someone else is not normal.
You make appeals to the middle class because you think most people will see that as an appeal to them. But people have very different definitions of that. And you could see that in your appeals, for instance, when you're thinking about the integration of immigrants. We usually say, you know, people are integrated when they're just like us. They want the same thing as we want. They live the same kind of life as we live. But I mean, two parents, two kids in a house with a car is not a universal goal. And by having, you know, appeal to the middle class can sometimes be exclusionary.
The idea of the middle class can be powerful. And if one of the benefits of a thriving middle class is stability, that's the thinking anyway, then the reality of the middle class is being shook. Just look at the median house price in Toronto. It's now more than $1 million.
Right now, our definition of what's a middle class lifestyle is most likely having income to spare, being able to own your home. I'm not sure that's going to be true if we keep, you know, that same standard around the median income. We're probably moving in the direction that being a homeowner below the median income is going to be a lot harder in the coming years. So either we're going to have much more people who don't feel that they have access to the middle class, or either our definition of what being in the middle class will have to adjust.
The middle class is like a big club. It's nice to feel like you belong. That's part of what makes it such an ideal political catch-all. The trick now is making sure everyone who wants to join actually can. On your radio and by podcast, this is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Haberschrood. When online shopping was new, it wasn't smooth like it is today. Now, you have one-click checkout, free shipping, and free returns. In the retail game, the goal is to make transactions frictionless. But as our producer Danielle Nerman finds, making stuff easier to buy online is also leading to something else. More fraud.
Tara Moore runs a coffee roastery and cafe in the postcard-perfect town of Brome Lake.
We obviously have a lake, but we also are within half an hour of about 4 or 5 ski hills. So this is everyone's playground from Montreal.
She also has an online store. It sells everything from coffee beans to Bodums. But last year, a couple of online shoppers left a bitter taste in her mouth. They ordered 2 fancy espresso machines. Tara shipped them off, and then the payments were reversed. The credit card holders said they had no knowledge of the orders, but
they also confirmed by email, because we like to give good customer service, did you receive the machine? Is everything good? And they wrote back, yes. Yep, they did.
In the end, the credit card companies sided with the cardholders. Tara lost the merch and was out $9,000. Chargebacks are meant to give us peace of mind. If someone steals your credit card number and buys champagne, caviar, and a pair of Jimmy Choo's, Visa, MasterCard, they won't make you pay.
And they say, like big heroes, oh, don't worry, we will take care of it. And you think, oh, great. Like, that's super customer service. We're off the hook.
But someone has to pay. And usually, it's the business.
You'd think that that payment processing system needs to be held accountable, right? They accepted this payment. We don't accept payments. We're coffee roasters. We're not a payment processor. We pay them for that service.
According to the payment processing company Moneris, chargebacks cost small businesses tens of millions of dollars every year. And they aren't always legit.
It's online shoplifting. Essentially, that's what it is.
Louis-Philippe Gauthier is with the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. He says some credit card holders are abusing the system, using chargebacks as a way to get free stuff.
If they have ill intent, will purposely say, I didn't buy this, and just keep the product. There's also sometimes the elements of impulse buying. I shouldn't have bought this, but I'm charging it back.
Online shopping makes it easier to scam the system. There's no face-to-face. Anyone can place an order and get it shipped anywhere. It doesn't surprise June Cott that some consumers are cheating. She's a behavioral economist and professor of marketing at Western University. June says there's a growing cynicism about retailers.
I think that right now we're in a moment where a lot of businesses are seen to be by consumers as like bad actors. So you have, for example, Joe Biden talking about shrinkflation and junk fees, and you have grocery manufacturers in Canada having to testify about, you know, their record profits as inflation's going up.
But we're not all jerks. Sometimes an online order takes so long to arrive, you think it's not coming and ask for your money back. Or you just forgot you bought that thing.
Maybe I could understand that for smaller charges.
But a high-end Italian espresso maker?
Like, no, you don't forget. Impossible.
The Canadian Federation of Independent Business has been pushing for changes so that merchants who follow the rules don't have to pay for sketchy chargebacks and have more power to fight back when credit card companies lay it all at their feet. And if you're like, why should I care? Well, Gauthier says the cost for all those chargebacks could get passed on to you through higher prices.
Eventually, everybody pays for theft. And that's the unfortunate thing that people don't necessarily remember.
For The Cost of Living, I'm Danielle Nerman.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Habershude. Cars come with so many options these days, it's hard to think of something you can't get. They have infrared night vision and drowsiness detectors that wake you up if your head bobs. You can have cup holders galore. Some SUVs offer an extra third row. But, Alice Cho, there's something most vehicles don't come with.
That's right. A place to put your purse.
Why don't you just toss it in the passenger seat?
Not if someone's sitting there. I'm talking about a place just for a purse. It's a real pet peeve for Peggy Worrell. She's in Swift Current, Saskatchewan. She's driven a lot of different cars over nearly 60 years, and for all that time, she's lived with the challenge of where to put that purse.
I could put it on the floor between my left foot and the door, and then my left foot had to kind of keep it squished there so it wouldn't, the strap or whatever, wouldn't interfere with my right foot that was driving.
I don't love hearing this for Peggy. That does not feel super safe.
No, and it's not super clean either, especially when it's winter in Saskatchewan. She also tosses it in the back seat, but it's an uncomfortable kind of awkward twist to reach for it, right? And she swears she tore her rotator cuff from doing that for years.
It's easy to think it's kind of a frivolous thing on the scale of human challenges, but if we can find places for our phones and our laptops, how is it that we can't find a place for our purses?
Why don't cars come with a spot for them?
Well, according to Sam Fiorani, it comes down to this.
The male-dominated designers haven't made it a priority.
Sam's an auto industry analyst and a car history buff. He says traditionally the car designers have been men. Even today, only a quarter of the industry is made up of women.
For far too long, men have been the only people designing cars. And while women have been in the studio for maybe 65, 70 years, they haven't been given the main job of designing vehicles. They have been doing interiors. They've been doing colors. They've been doing trim.
Instead, the industry has paid a lot of attention to performance, like more powerful engines or tech. Think Bluetooth, shoulder check sensors. Storage hasn't been a big focus.
So basically he's saying the patriarchy doesn't make a place for purses. All right. But, you know, a lot of people, women and men, we carry something, a purse, a backpack, a messenger bag, and all of those things need to go somewhere.
Yeah. And there's another reason why storage is hard to come by. Cars have changed.
Back in the 70s, the average American car was well over 18 feet long. It was super wide. It had a room for this bench seat, and you could have space between you and the other two passengers in the front row. It was just a bigger vehicle.
Yeah, if you're cruising around in your 77 Buick Riviera, you got that bench seat, you have acres of space for your purse.
Yeah, cars were boats back then. But then bucket seats came along, and the gearbox moved to the middle, and it made everything more squishy in the front.
Okay, yeah, but if you look at a lot of today's SUVs, they're not exactly small. They can't find more room for storage?
Well, it depends. I mean, vans and trucks are bigger. They've got more room for more stuff. But on average, space is at a premium in gas-powered vehicles, SUVs included. Camilla Palmertz is a former engineer for Volvo in Sweden.
You need to fill it with like cables and stuff that you can crash with the car safe and so on. So the spaces are very few. So you really need to fight for your spaces.
So potential storage space is taken up by safety features and all the tech that's needed for the bells and whistles.
Yeah, there are hundreds of wires and cables in a vehicle because of all the new tech. And then there's airbags. Since they became standard in the 90s, they've been taking up a lot of room. They're in the dashboard, the steering wheel, and some are in the doors.
Yeah, but just from a feature standpoint, you know, marketing a vehicle, differentiating it from other vehicles, you'd think someone would find some extra space for our bags.
Well, Camilla and her team did. 20 years ago, she was in charge of a concept car for Volvo. It was the first car ever designed entirely by women. And they focused on things like smart handling, safety, and storage.
We took away the handbrake and shift gear. So the mid part was like full of storage from the back to the front. So it's not so difficult.
So they moved the gearbox in the middle and put it where?
Right in the steering wheel. There are these little paddles that stuck out from the center of the steering wheel. That left room for a long console in the middle of the car with sliding lids. So you could drop your handbag, your laptop bag into this bin, slide the lid shut, and poof, it's out of sight.
So what became of this design?
It was a concept car, a prototype. They don't normally go into mass production. But you can see that some of their ideas are in cars today, like parallel parking assist technology, modular back seats, gear shifts in the steering column.
But no purse place.
Not in most cars, but there was a time when a car did come with a purse holder.
Don't need to shift that gear.
No clutch to fight.
A booty gear. It's automatic power flight.
Back in 1955, North America was booming after the war, and more women were driving. Sam Fiorani says Chrysler came out with a car just for women, and it was called the Dodge La Femme.
They were pink or white or purple. They included pink interior and matching raincoat, an umbrella, and a compact with a lipstick. So it was so that the woman could match her car.
That is some pretty 1950s thinking.
And Paul, it even came with its own matching purse. But it was a flop. It was a total flop. La Femme disappeared after 2 years, and it taught automakers a lesson.
You can sell a man's vehicle to a woman, but you can't sell a woman's vehicle to a man. And because of this, they stopped making female-exclusive vehicles and figured that enough women would buy the cars they already built for men.
And that was it for the experiment with gendered cars?
Pretty much. Sam says it's all about unisex marketing nowadays, right? They want to sell to as many people as possible. And then there's EVs. The industry is changing because of them, and they have more room for storage. Constance Smith is a former industrial designer for GM.
Well, in the EVs, of course, you know, they're creating what's called frunks, which is they use the front of the vehicle under the hood, which is the hood for storage, and we didn't have that space before, so we have a lot more space.
The frunk!
Yeah, the front trunk.
Okay, so, you know, the frunk opens up some storage possibilities. Do we know how the auto industry is thinking about this, Ellis? Like, is it into making more room for bags?
Well, some automakers are carving out more storage spaces. And everyone I spoke to said the auto industry is open to feedback. So Camilla says if more people want a place for a purse, they should speak up.
the car industry will listen. They should be smart and listen. We know that women take 80% of all the decisions, and this is valid also for deciding which car they want.
I mean, half the drivers on the road are women. And like Camila says, they have a lot of influence on what kind of car the family buys.
I feel like I know one person who's going to write into her automaker, and that is Peggy.
Peggy Worrell in Swift Current. She sure will. And the next time she goes shopping for a car,
I will definitely be looking for an EV, and I will ask for an EV with a space for my purse.
Yeah. Stay safe, Peggy. Keep that purse off the floor.
And off the back seat.
Thanks, Alice.
Thanks, Paul.
Coming up next week, if you were a rave kid in the 90s, you remember mod robes. The baggy neon buckle clip pants were fat. That's spelled with a PH. They weren't for everyone, but they were for Alex Curry.
He would remind me, like, every 6 months how much he loved these pants and how they were just the best pants ever. Yeah. So then he starts to go into it again, and I'm kind of rolling my eyes because we've been together for almost 20 years, and I've heard this speech several times. So he said, I wonder if I could still buy these pants.
Like even used on eBay, whatever. And I start shopping around online, and I see right away that he had just listed the brand for sale literally 2 weeks earlier.
Yeah.
Alex and his wife Zoe ended up buying the Mod Robes brand. And it's not the only brand to rise from the ashes. But when an undead brand is resurrected, are you always getting the real McCoy? That's next week. The Cost of Living is based in Calgary. The show is produced by Daniel Nerman, Ellis Cho, and Jennifer Keane. Our executive producer is Tracy Johnson. I'm Paul Havershrood. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.